As far as the vision in Daniel chapter 2, we recall that Nebuchadnezzar had a dream. And what we'll do is we'll just hop over into verse 36. Verse 31. And we'll just go briefly through the interpretation of the dream. So Daniel says, "You, O king, were watching, and behold, a great image. This great image, whose splendor was excellent, stood before you, and its form was awesome. This image's head was of fine gold, its chest and arms of silver, its belly and thighs of bronze, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. You watched while a stone was cut out without hands, which struck the image on its feet of iron and clay, and broke them in pieces. When the iron, the clay, the bronze, the silver, and the gold were crushed together and became like chaff from the summer threshing floors, the wind carried them away so that no trace of them was found. And the stone that struck the image became a great mountain and filled the whole earth. This is the dream. Now we will tell the interpretation." As soon as, in verse 37, as soon as Daniel says, "You, O king, are this head of gold," I think we basically know what the rest of the book is about. And what, as Daniel explains, it's going to be a succession of kingdoms beginning with Babylon, of which King Nebuchadnezzar is the king at that time. And each one is going to succeed the other. And it becomes obvious just looking back on history from this time point. We're talking about Babel, then Medo-Persia, then the Greeks, and then the fourth kingdom is Rome. Rome is the Iron Kingdom here. And we notice some things right away. Daniel will explain to him that after you, well, let's read verse 37. "You, O king, are a king of kings, for the God of heaven has given you a kingdom, power, strength, and glory." Those four things are given Nebuchadnezzar by God, and we discussed that all authority comes from God. And you'll notice when you go to read Revelation the next time you read it, there are a number of accolades that both God the Father and Christ receive, and they're going to be mirrored by the accolades that we see here given Nebuchadnezzar. "For yours is the strength and the power and the glory and the honor forever. Amen." This is echoed right here in this vision. "To you have been given kingdom, power, strength, and glory. And wherever the children of men dwell, or the beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand and has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold." So Nebuchadnezzar has vast and wide dominion. And this is echoed by what we see on the creation week. When Adam is created, he is given dominion over a handful of things. Do you remember what those things are? They're actually mentioned in this verse, so it's not that tricky. He was given dominion over the land, over the beasts of the land, over the birds of the air, but not the air itself, and over the beasts of the sea, but not the sea itself. And it's very specific in Genesis, those particular things. Adam was given dominion over the earth, meaning the land itself, and the beast. He was given authority or dominion over nothing else, except for the beasts of those various dominions. And we see this, what Nebuchadnezzar is being told here. Excuse me. "The beasts of the field and the birds of heaven, he has given them into your hand. He has made you ruler over them all. You are this head of gold. But after you shall arise another kingdom inferior to yours." Now in Isaiah, Babylon is called the Golden City. And everybody that studies Babylon understands that this was a city like no other. It was a spectacular city. There's strong evidence that Nebuchadnezzar basically beggared the entire Mesopotamian almost just to build up the city of Babylon. It was that impressive. And each empire after this, while it's less splendorous, you'll notice that each of these metals in succession, what it loses in quality, it gains in strength. So silver is stronger than gold. It's not as pretty, and we don't deem it as valuable, but it is more durable. Brass or bronze is obviously more durable than silver, even though it also is less valuable. And then iron is the least pretty of all of them, but it's the strongest and the most lasting. And what we'll notice when we look at history is each of these empires is shorter than the one that follows. Nebuchadnezzar's empire only lasted about 75 years, give or take a year. The Persians lasted about almost 200 years. And then the Greeks lasted about 300 years. And then the Romans lasted for 600 years. And if you transfer that to the Byzantine Empire in the east, then it lasted even another 1,000 years beyond that. So each empire, while less pretty than the one before it, gained in strength and durability. Until we get to this curious bit in the bottom, verse 35, he says, verse 33, its legs of iron, its feet partly of iron and partly of clay. Let's hop down to what he says about this fourth kingdom starting in the 40th verse. And the fourth kingdom shall be as strong as iron, inasmuch as iron breaks in pieces and shatters everything. And like iron that crushes, that kingdom will break in pieces and crush all the others. Now, you have to keep in mind, a vision is a contained thing. So what this is saying is that the Roman Empire is going to crush elements of all the previous empires. So not only will the Roman Empire defeat the Greek kingdoms, but if you know your Roman history, they also whipped up people from Persia, and they also whipped up people from Mesopotamia. They whipped up everybody. In some way, these cultures are going to persist, and Rome is going to smash them all, is what it's saying. So whereas you saw the feet and toes, partly of potter's clay and partly of iron, the kingdom shall be divided, yet the strength of the iron shall be in it, just as you saw the iron mixed with ceramic clay. And as the toes of the feet were partly of iron and partly of clay, so the kingdom shall be partly strong and partly fragile. As you saw iron mixed with ceramic clay, there they will mingle with the seed of men, but they will not adhere to one another, just as iron does not mix with clay. And in the days of these kings, the God of heaven will set up a kingdom which will never be destroyed, and the kingdom shall not be left to other people. It shall break in pieces and consume all those kingdoms, and it shall stand forever. So here we have the interpretation of the end of these kingdoms. In the days of those kings, it says, will this eternal kingdom be established. And that's an easy one, because that's going to be Jesus Christ and the church. This is important, but there is going to be something about the gospel that is going to undo these kingdoms. And because sometimes when people talk about this, they talk about it kind of fancifully and whatnot. But there's something literally inherent in the gospel that is going to weaken these kingdoms and help bring them to their final destiny. Now, that is a very vague and skeletal outline of history from Daniel's day until the end of time. Chapter 7 is going to flesh this vision out a little bit. So we can look at Daniel 2 as kind of the skeletal framework upon which the history and the visions of Daniel proceed. And Daniel 7 will give us a little bit more information on that. In this morning's lesson, I mentioned that this was probably given about 50 years after Daniel chapter 1. If Daniel was taken and a few handful of other elite young men was taken to Babylon in about 603 or so, and we're told here that this was the first year of Belshazzar. Belshazzar was the son of the Babylonian king named Nabonidus. And Nabonidus left Babylon in 553 for Arabia, and he was spent his time there building temples and whatnot. And he left his son Belshazzar in charge of administration of the Babylonian Empire. So Daniel's first vision is received in this first year, 553, about 50 years after Daniel chapter 1 and 2. And this is about one decade and a half before Cyrus the Persian will conquer the known world. And it would be a decade of decline and increasing unrest within Babylon. However, when Daniel first receives this vision, it was probably hard even for him to fathom that the silver kingdom mentioned in Daniel 2 was going to replace the gold head anytime soon. The other thing I'll point out about Daniel chapter 7 is there's only one vision. And it follows the pattern of what we see in Daniel chapter 2. That is, you have the vision, and then you have an explanation. The explanation includes different and more information than the original vision. And that's just the pattern. And we'll note in verse 15 of Daniel 7, I, Daniel, was grieved in my spirit within my body, and the visions of my head troubled me. I came near to one of those who stood by and asked him the truth of all this. So just like in Revelation, we have Daniel actually interacting with members of his vision. So it's a vision that he has in his head at night, and it gives you kind of the impression that he's sleeping, but he can still interact with it. And this, during this conversation with the angel, he recalls to his mind more things that he saw in the vision. So it's not two. It's one vision that is expanded on a little later. So technically, the first vision, or the vision of Daniel chapter 7, runs through verse 14. And then the explanation starts in verse 17 with the phrase, those great beasts which you saw. And it is, or which are four. Are four kings which arise out of the earth. But the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom and possess the kingdom forever, even forever and ever. And those two verses basically encapsulate in short form the entire vision. There are four kingdoms of the earth, which means they're going to be historically identifiable kingdoms. And the saints of the Most High shall receive the kingdom. So you may recall the Beatitudes. What was said about those who would inherit the earth? They had to be what? Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. There's a lot of interesting phraseology like that from the Old Testament on through the book of Revelation about inheriting the earth. Well, that's because Rome is basically, in my view, in both Daniel and Revelation, is the ruler of the nations and is the ruler of the earth. And it's this particular kingdom that's set up in opposition to God and His Christ, Jesus Christ the Messiah, that's going to be set up in opposition. And it's this kingdom that Christ is going to prove His power. And He's going to do it in historic times. In other words, this punishment that is meted out on the beast is first a secular historical punishment. And then after he's punished, he's just hanging around waiting for the last day, which will be his final destruction. And we'll talk about that a little bit more as we go through the vision itself. So, chapter 7, verse 1. In the first year of Belshazzar, king of Babylon, Daniel had a dream and visions of his head while on his bed. Then he wrote down the dream, telling the main facts. Daniel spoke, saying, I saw in my visions by night, and behold, the four winds of heaven were stirring up the great sea. And four great beasts came up from the sea, each different from the other. All right. These are the things that we'll take a quick look at. But there are several elements in here. The first that we'll consider is the great sea. And my basic rule for interpretation is any element of a vision like this, the first thing you need to consider is how does the Bible use that in other contexts? And I always give precedence to the Bible on all these. So whether we're talking about the lion or the bear or the leopard, what the Bible says about lions, bears, and leopards is more important than what a biologist would say about lions and bears and leopards. But in that, I don't discredit things that we just commonly know about those animals and associations we make. I also don't totally discount things that even a pagan would say about those things, because all of these things were given in a cultural context. And the first thing we need to come to a conclusion of is this great sea. Now, Revelation already answers it for us, so it's pretty easy. But in a description of the harlot riding on the beast in Revelation 17, he tells us that the waters which you saw are peoples, multitudes, nations, and tongues. And in Revelation 13, we have a beast from the earth, and we have a beast from the sea. Those things are not actually opposed to one another. Because we remember in verse 17, the angel said, these are four kings which will arise out of the earth. And yet here we have them coming up out of the sea. What he means by earth is dominion, just like we saw with Nebuchadnezzar. What he means by sea is the chaotic mix of peoples that we call humanity, and the things that are going to take place that give rise to these beasts. So, we have this sea, which are basically the known world, is the way we want to look at it. And then we have these four winds. If you turn to Jeremiah chapter 49, is a series of judgments against a lot of the Mesopotamian powers and the people surrounding Israel. And he gets to Elam, and in verse 35 he says, thus says the Lord of hosts, behold, I will break the bow of Elam, the foremost of their might. Against Elam I will bring the four winds from the four quarters of heaven and scatter them toward all those winds. There shall be no nations where the outcasts of Elam will not go. So there's four winds and there's four quarters of the earth. Each wind corresponds to a quarter of the earth. Now you have to think about yourself as a Jew standing in Jerusalem. You have east, west, north, and south. The words for those directions actually are correspond to how they face. So we're oriented north because we grew up in the age of the compass. So we think north, east, etc. So north is our primary direction. But to the ancients, the primary direction was east. So the reason you can translate Benjamin as son of the south or son of the right hand is because their word for south was right hand, north was left hand. The word for west was in back of or behind, etc. And no matter where you were as a Jew, you were surrounded by enemies at all times. You had Egypt in the south, all the Mesopotamian powers in the north. Elam was one of the primary powers, and it was one of the main powers in the east. And then, of course, to the west, you had the Phoenicians, who we call Tyre and Sidon. But you would also have other new powers come along, like the Lydians and the Greeks eventually. But this north-south-east framework goes through the rest of the book. Most importantly, in chapter 11, which are primarily about the king of the north versus the king of the south, and how those two warring factions are going to affect God's people. Because that's basically the concern of the book. How does the rest of the story of God's people fit within this imperial framework? And how are these empires going to interact with God's people? And what God is actually warning Daniel is that eventually the Israelites are going to face a serious time of tribulation that is going to test their faith and cause a lot of harm. So it's basically a warning. So the sea, we have the sea and we have these four winds. We can also look to Revelation chapter 7. And we'll see that God controls these winds. So after these, verse 1, after these things, I saw four angels standing at the four corners of the earth, holding the four winds of the earth, that the wind should not blow on the earth, on the sea, or on any tree. And verse 3, we'll skip forward, saying, do not harm the earth, the sea, or the trees, till we have sealed the servants of God on their foreheads. So we have this time period here where God is asking them to restrain from releasing these winds. And as it turns out, the story is picked up in chapter 8 after the sealing. And we understand that these four winds are empires or peoples that are going to come and destroy the Roman Empire, at least in the West. So from Daniel chapter 8, we also see them. But what we understand from all the verses in the Old Testament talk about the four winds is that the winds destroy and divide, sunder, and scatter, but always to a purpose. And it seems that that purpose is to remake the world in some fashion. So what's going to happen is sometime before the rise of Babylon, we see these four winds, and in Hebrew it says they strove upon the waters. But the Greek is kind of interesting because it says the winds kept assaulting the water. But in all cases, it has a military tint to the word. So in Hebrew, it can mean fall upon, so like you fall upon your enemies, etc. This is very different than what we see on creation. In Genesis chapter 1, it says the Spirit of God hovered over the face of the deep. And you see, from there, you see God's creative impulse. And what God is doing is making it so that life can thrive. And He's bringing order to His creation. And He's making rules and laws. This is the opposite. It's a chaotic, complex mix. So what he's saying is that before Babylon rises, there's going to be a time of great turbulence. And that time began in 626. That's almost exactly 20 years before Daniel ends up in Babylon. But in 626, the greatest power on earth for the previous 1,000 years. Now, I want you to think about that in context. If you were a Jew, there were only two real powers that you grew up knowing. Assyria in the north and Egypt in the south. And those two powers had been basically in charge of the world for 1,500 years. So, Assyria goes from the apex of its power in the early 600s to being conquered and left in the dust. Literally, it wasn't known where Nineveh was for thousands of years, even though it was one of the greatest cities on the earth. So in 626, there was an Assyrian civil war, and they warred constantly for the throne of Assyria for about a decade. And then Babylon and the Medes and the Persians and the Sumerians and the Scythians and basically everybody in the known world that had been ruled by Assyria joins in a revolt. And it still takes all those people another decade. So it takes, Assyria was so powerful, it took 20 years of constant civil war and then a revolt by basically everybody else in the known world to bring it down. That's how powerful Assyria was. At the height of their power, just earlier in this century, every year, 150,000 young men came of age and was capable of fighting in the military. At any time, an Assyrian king could have called upon veterans, about 750,000 in number. Now, that doesn't seem like so big a force in our day, but in that ancient time, that was a huge number. 750,000 men who were veterans and had campaigned before and had been successful in every campaign that they had ever accomplished. That's how hard it was to bring down Assyria. It was basically everybody that was a vassal of Assyria had to take part in this revolt. The other thing to consider is just who the vassals are and the time period that we're looking at. And this is how powerful Assyria was. Assyria made vassals of the Medes and the Persians and the Babylonians and the Scythians and the Sumerians. Basically, if you can think of a people group from that time and place, they were vassals to the Assyrians. So out of that 20-year chaos is going to emerge a new world order. And the new world order that replaces the old one is going to look much different than the one that came before. So if you look in Daniel chapter 4, we see Nebuchadnezzar at the peak of his power. And he can look from one end of heaven to the other and say, "This is mine," etc. It's interesting, one of the titles of Nebuchadnezzar that is used on his inscriptions is King of the Universe. King of the Universe. And in that time and place, it had a connotation of a celestial quality to it. Like he was related to the gods, so to speak. And so he had powers and authorities beyond even this realm. One of the traditional titles that he never took was King of the Four Corners of the World. To earn that title in Mesopotamia, a king had to defeat his primary foe in each compass point. So you had to campaign against your main enemy in the north, south, east, and west. And if you were successful, you could call yourself King of the Four Corners of the World. Now, this title skipped around dynasties and cultures, but by far, Assyrians took this title more so than any other. It was a title that had to be earned, and more Assyrians earned that title than any other. And the last document that this title dates to is the fourth year of Ashurbanipal's son. That's 627 BC, the year before the Assyrian civil war started. In the last 12 months before the revolt began. And no king would ever take this title again except one. And that was Cyrus the Persian after he conquered Babylon. Nearly 100 years later, he was the last man to ever use king of the four corners of the earth. And I think that's a pretty good way to think of this time period, is those 100 years roughly, there's going to be an overturning of an old world system. The two main powers and the two ancillary powers of the previous world were Assyria in the north, Egypt in the south, Elam in the east, and Tyre to the west. Once this century of change is over, that's going to be completely overturned, and you'll eventually end up with the Medo-Persians and the Lydians, and then they'll get conquered, and the Greeks will rise up, and then the Romans will rise up. It's just one world system is giving way to another. Any questions? Or I guess the last point I will make is you have to understand what the Jews thought of the earth and the world. Their concept of the world and the earth was really small. So basically, when you get to Genesis chapter 10, 11, their idea of the world was basically Mesopotamia and parts of the eastern Mediterranean. But what's happening in Daniel is the world just keeps getting bigger and bigger. And that into the Jewish mind. And eventually it's going to mention in chapter 11 ships from Kittim, which means ships from the west. And that's going to be Rome. So eventually the world's going to get closer to what you and I think of it as the world. So when Nebuchadnezzar said he ruled the world, it was just this area of Mesopotamia. But then it's going to expand with the Persian Empire, which is even bigger, then the Greeks, which is even bigger, and then the Romans, which is further west. So the world's just going to keep expanding outward. All right, any questions or comments before we start looking at some of these empires individually? All right. Daniel would have been surrounded by lions for most of his life. Lions were one of the most popular symbols in Babylon, in Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. It was an old symbol for kingship, so I think it's also appropriate in that way. You have to recall in chapter 2, Nebuchadnezzar was told that another kingdom shall arise inferior to yours. So in a real sense, Babylon gave us a new idea of empire. And it was one that would establish this ideal that was established would last for a long time, because Babylon to the ancients would always maintain a particular mystique that other empires never could. When Alexander died, he died in Babylon, and he had big plans for Babylon. He actually was intending to make it the capital of his new empire, and this was in spite of what God had said was going to happen. Because there was just some appeal to Babylon that these others would not ever have. So Babylon becomes this imperial ideal. And so this lion being symbolized in Nebuchadnezzar's empire is actually quite appropriate. And we also have to keep in mind that God had a purpose, and that was for a lot of nations to be punished, not just Judah. So the timing of Babylon was such that it was the one instrument God used to punish Judah. Here we have this quotation from Jeremiah 25. But he was also there to punish the Tyrians and lots of other people that God wanted punished for their sins. And he is called the destroyer of nations. Because that's one thing the Babylonians were very good at. They were good at weakening nations and then taking their peoples and assimilating them and acculturating them into Babylonian culture. That's what his goal with the young men was in Daniel chapter 1. When you think about what he's doing, he's taking the elites of the Jews. These would be the upper class boys who would have been the best educated. They knew how to read and think and study. He was taking the future leadership of the Jews and trying to turn them into Babylonians. And then he made them eunuchs so that they would also not have a legacy. Those are things that they weren't done by accident. The Babylonians knew how to lop off the future of a people. You take their leadership, and if you can't suborn them to your own cause, then you basically just get rid of them. So these young men proved an important lesson to Nebuchadnezzar. That they could follow their own God and their own ways and still be good employees, I guess, for lack of a better word. That there was no reason that they couldn't maintain their own identity and their own spirituality separate from Babylon and not still be useful in the administration of his empire. But there's always going to be this worldly impulse to, you know, be like us. Come in. Don't separate yourselves and be different. And what has God told us in Peter? He wants us to be a royal priesthood, a chosen generation, his own special people, distinct. You could also say peculiar. Peculiar in the sense of standing apart. Jesus said that we are always going to be in the world, but not of the world. So Nebuchadnezzar's kingdom was the ideal, and it was good at acculturating people and bringing people into its identity. Reminder that he said, you are this head of gold, and you see the years there, roughly 605 to 539. But interestingly enough, in the oldest copies of the Old Testament that we have, it's actually, instead of a lion there in verse 4, it says lioness. And so he says the first was like a lion. In most of the oldest versions, it's actually like a lioness and had eagle's wings. This could be actually the way it was intended to be, because after all, he is Babylon in Isaiah 47:5 is called the Lady of Kingdoms. And if you think in terms of what Babylon is supposed to typify, you're supposed to be able to look forward in time to the book of Revelation when there's another power called Babylon. And in chapter 17, she's described as a harlot. So this is the idea of her being able to seduce people into her identity. That could be the case. However, lionesses also famously do the hunting for their prides, so they're no less fierce than the males are in many respects. So these references that we see here in Proverbs 30 and Hosea, they're all about how fierce the lion is when it comes to its prey. So we notice in all these visions that they're all predatory in nature. And each of these kingdoms is going to devour the one that precedes it. And that's in part what makes this series of kingdoms unique, is that the one that follows is the one that ended its predecessor. The eagle's wings have two main purposes in symbolic language in the Old Testament. The first one that we see here is the swift capture of enemies. All of those verses, Deuteronomy 28, 49, 2 Samuel 1, etc., they all have to do with the eagle's ability to look down from a safe place, a safe height, and swoop down and grab whatever it wants, whenever it wants. The second main usage in Scripture is the swift escape from enemies. You'll recall Exodus 19, the Israelites' escape from Egypt is compared to being lifted up on eagle's wings. We see that allusion in Isaiah 40:31 as well. And looking forward to the Christian eschaton when he says, they shall mount up on eagle's wings. Another instance we have is Revelation 12:14, where we have a woman there who I think is symbolic of the church. She's fitted with two wings of a great eagle, and then she's able to fly above this flood that comes from Satan's mouth. So this is evidence of the ability to escape, capture. So we have the quick building, if you will, or construction of the Babylonian Empire, which only took about 20 years, from 626 to 605. But their inability to escape the conquest of Cyrus the Persian. And I think this plays in a little bit to what we have next in the figure, which is we see that, and it was lifted up from the earth and made to stand on 2 feet like a man, and a man's heart was given to it. Again, I just look at what the Bible says about these various things. And if we were to turn to Isaiah 31, verse 4, it says, as a lion roars and a young lion over his prey, when a multitude of shepherds is summoned against him, he will not be afraid of their voice nor be disturbed by their noise. So a lion that's secure and is well fed, he just feels so sure of himself that there's nothing that can cause him fear. There's no number of shepherds, and there's a reason he calls them shepherds, because shepherds usually don't carry swords and such. So the lion is completely safe. He's fearless and bold and undaunted. by his enemies. However, a man's heart, we're told by Jeremiah in 17:9, is what? Remember what it says about a man's heart? The heart is deceitful above all things and deceptively wicked. That is the heart of a man that is given to this beast, and he's made to stand up on his two feet after he loses his wings. So, like a man, he's stupidly arrogant and unaware of the catastrophe that's about to befall him. This is a picture of Babylon after Nebuchadnezzar dies. If Nebuchadnezzar's empire had lasted longer, he would be called Nebuchadnezzar the Great. He really would. The reason he's not is because his empire only lasted a couple decades longer than he did. The kings that came after Nebuchadnezzar, they just were not him. They weren't as smart. They weren't as intelligent. They weren't as energetic. They didn't have his vision. And things after Nebuchadnezzar died slowly but surely began to fall apart until they were so thoroughly weakened. But not just weakened, they were deluded about their current situation. They thought that they would stick behind Babylon with its high walls and that they would just be invincible. They thought that they would outlast the Persians, that the Persians, like water, would rush up on the walls of Babylon only to have to be forced to recede. And after a little bit, the Persians would just give up, go back to their mountains and forget all about Babylon. That is obviously not what happened. When you think about Babylon and its fall, you want to think about Isaiah 48. And in that passage, it talks about how stupidly dependent the Babylonians were on their enchanters and their wizards and their mediums and their stargazers. They literally had guys. So the king would say, okay, I've got this enemy out there, this enemy army. I want to go attack him with my army by surprise tomorrow while he's sleeping. They would literally have these guys pull up these old, you know, astrological charts and say, well, here's the thing, king. See, if you take your army out and surprise them tomorrow, it's not going to end up good. So they were literally making decisions based on things that have been written down based on astrological charts 1,000, 1,500 years earlier, when anybody in their right mind would know that if you can get surprise on your enemy, then you have a good chance of coming out on top. So they were literally making decisions based on star charts and signs of the zodiac type stuff and taking it seriously. And that's the major part of the problem with those things, besides the fact that they don't give any honor to God. So instead of doing things that made sense, they did things that didn't make sense. Instead of doing things that would build up their defenses, they did things solely relying on statues and stargazers, etc. We see this in Daniel chapter 5, where Belshazzar brings in the articles of the temple of God, and he and his wives and his concubines, etc., drinking out of these instruments. And there's no thought about paying respect to the God of heaven, as he's very often called in the book of Daniel. So they weren't thinkers at this point, and they surely weren't thinking. God had sent them some kind of delusion, I think, that just made them make poor choices constantly. So their empire, which only took 20 years to build, took just a matter of months to actually fall to Cyrus once he had invaded it. So that's the heart of a man versus the heart of a lion. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. All right, is there anything on Babylonian lion? I'll talk about how many wings he has coming up. All right, in the verse 5, and suddenly another beast, a second like a bear, it was raised up on one side and had three ribs in its mouth between its teeth. And they said thus to it, arise, devour much flesh. Now the picture I have of this bear is he's got ribs in his mouth, and so he's eaten, but he's being encouraged not to stop. So I kind of have this picture in my head of a bear that stuffed himself right before he's about to hibernate. And he's being encouraged, don't rest yet, you have still more to conquer. So we have to keep in mind, Daniel is seeing this in 553, but he's seeing this bear first come up as it appears once it has conquered Babylon. So there's a couple things in play here. It has to be an initial picture of the conquest of Babylon in 539. And the three ribs are going to be three kingdoms that it had recently devoured, evidenced by the fact that it had not yet swallowed the ribs. They're still in its mouth and he's still chewing on them. So they have to be three recent conquests. And the reason I say that is because a lot of schemes will have the three conquests as Lydia, Babylon, and Egypt. The problem is when the Persians conquer Babylon in 539, Egypt will not be conquered for another 15 years. So the initial view that he has is Lydia, Elam, and Babylon, and you can see how recent they were. Lydia, no later than 542, but Elam is sure at 540. He conquered it literally just a few months before he conquered Babylon. And we don't talk much about Elam because they were so far from the kingdoms of Israel and Judah. But for 1,500, almost 2,000 years, Elam was one of the major powers in the world. And they're being punished for all kinds of despicable things. They had a very degraded culture, I'll just put it that way. So God was certainly right to end their dynasties. And they'll never have another native Elamite dynasty. And that's kind of the point, is when does native dynastic rule end? And you can say that's the end of these empires. But he's encouraged from the standpoint of 539 to keep going. You have more to conquer. And so those would be the conquests of Cambyses, his son, and Darius the Great, his nephew. They would go on to conquer basically North Africa, parts of East Africa, but also a major part of Southeast Europe. And that's going to be Darius that conquers mostly Southeast Europe. And that sets him in direct opposition to the Greeks. He had his eyes on Greece, and he definitely wanted to conquer those countries. So that's the image we have of the bear. And then he says, and after this, I looked, and there was another like a leopard, which had on its back four wings like a bird. The beast also had four heads, and dominion was given to it. This is going to be the kingdom of bronze that we see in Daniel chapter 2. We're not told much about leopards in the Bible, but what we have is very instructive. We're told in Jeremiah 5:6 that leopards lie in wait, and in Hosea 13 that they lurk by the path. We know that leopards are very patient stalkers and hunters. They're always ready. And I think this is probably an allusion to the time period between the Ionian Revolt and the time that Alexander invaded the Persian Empire. Once we have the time of Darius, we're right there at what's called the Greco-Persian Wars. And if you know your Greek and Persian history, they're like love and marriage. As soon as you start talking about one, you have to talk about the other. And their histories run side by side for quite some time. So the Greeks are just waiting for the perfect time to end, is the way I see that, to end the Persian Empire. And for about 150 years, 170 years, that's exactly what they do, is wait. Now, he's got four wings, which is twice the number of wings that the lion has. And I mentioned that it was about 20 years for the Babylonian Empire to be constructed. Alexander constructed his empire in half the time, 10. So to do it in half the time, you have to have twice the speed. But he doesn't have wings of an eagle. Now, there is a sense here where an eagle is just a more royal bird. It's a greater bird. So that could be what it means, is just Alexander's empire isn't as splendorous, so he doesn't get eagle's wings. But the other possibility is that the Bible does talk several times about eagle's nests and how high they are and how inviolable they are and inviolate. Usually the figure is that if someone's castle or fort is described as an eagle's nest, it's impenetrable. An enemy can't conquer it. And I think we may have an allusion here to the inherent instability of the Greek kingdoms themselves, which is unlike Nebuchadnezzar, who in chapter 4 says is at rest in his kingdom and in his palace. These Greek empires, these Greek kingdoms that follow Alexander, they're just a constant war. And reading that history can be chaotic and a mess, but there's really just no time for them to relax. They're always constantly at war. Which brings us to the four heads. Now, when you see a figure like this, you have to keep in mind it's one empire that has four heads. Now, the church has one head. Your household has one head. And as we all know, things will always work better if they just have one head. But this is one empire, one cultural hegemony that has been split into four heads. It's not going to work because every head is going to want what's best for it. It's going to want to take everything in its own direction. And basically, from the time of Alexander's death, about a decade or so after his death, they're fighting one another for supremacy all the time. And eventually you're going to get to where there's two main ones. They are the Seleucid Syrians in the north and the Ptolemaic Egyptians in the south. And those are the kings of the north and the kings of the south in Daniel chapter 11, respectively. There's also, it says, dominion was given over to it. And I think it's because at this point in history with the four kingdoms that follow Alexander, every direction you look, the primary power is a Greek power. It also occurred to me that this may be an allusion to the fact that the power center of the ancient world is going to start migrating west. It goes from Mesopotamia to the Aegean, and it's going to keep migrating west until it gets to Rome and the Italian peninsula. And honestly, when you look at world history from this point forward, it's a remarkable transformation that takes place. But the gravity of power is still Europe. Or at least it was until World War II. And so for a long time, the great story of history is primarily a Mediterranean and then a European one. And the last slide is the kingdom of iron is described, and that's what we're going to spend a good deal of time talking about in one of the later sessions. But I pulled this quote from Gibbon because it's pretty interesting. "The arms of the Republic, sometimes vanquished in battle, always victorious in war, advanced with rapid steps to the Euphrates, the Danube, the Rhine, and the ocean, and the images of gold, of silver, or brass that might serve to represent the nations and their kings were successively broken by the iron monarchy of Rome." So it wasn't just the Bible, but historians in general have noted the flavor of these kingdoms. And the one thing you'll notice about gold and silver is that they don't make the best weapons. But when we get to the Greeks, we see them with bronze, which is very good for weapons, and then iron, which is even better. And it's interesting just how this tiny little Greek kingdom, that should have no chance of defeating the Persians, is going to whip them all over battlefields for 100+ years before Alexander comes along and then just sweeps the Persians off of the map for a good long time. So it's pretty interesting how history works out. And God was able to foresee all this. So in a couple of weeks, Lord willing, we'll pick up. And really, chapter 7, you look at it as the spine of the entire book. And everything builds on that. So we'll take a little bit more of a look at that, and then we'll continue on with the visions from there.